supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Starting today, Enon Tabernacle Baptist Church is hosting 4 courtrooms to help process a backlog of bench warrants and parole violations. It's part of an effort called Project Safe Return. For WHYY, Kyrie Greenberg went to see who was showing up to clear their records.
Annette Bird came to support her daughter Sharon, who, like 60% of Philadelphians with parole violations, has mental health and substance abuse problems. She says it's been hard to get Sharon treatment, but it was easy at Enon Tabernacle because social services are integrated into the Safe Return project.
And we were set up with a program, an appointment for next week. So everything that they promise you, they are producing.
And unlike going to regular court, there's applause.
That would be the welcome committee.
That was for Dominique Ross, who just had her bench warrant dropped. She says she was charged with a misdemeanor when she was 17 and missed her court date. And recently,
I was driving. We got pulled over. Then he told me, like, yeah, you have a warrant. And I, you know what I told him, the cop? I said, you're lying. And he was like, no, you do. And I'm like, I forgot about it.
She's set to graduate college soon and says turning herself in was a relief.
I think this is, like, a really good program for people who want to do the right thing, but they kind of, like, scared or nervous about, like, the outcomes.
The probation department says people with outstanding warrants are most concentrated in South and Southwest Philly. Alan Waller, one of the pastors at Enon Tabernacle, is driving a van from Broad and Olney to the church, so transportation isn't a hindrance. He says the church's congregation, which includes 15,000 members, has been spreading the word. Getting the message personally helps, he says. It lets people know they'll be welcomed.
So no perp walk, none of that. Yeah, you will see no one in handcuffs, I promise you.
Philadelphia's Safe Return continues through Thursday, 10 a.m. to 3. For WHYY News, Kyrie Greenberg.
Gentrification is often associated with the displacement of poor homeowners or renters as new construction and renovation transform old neighborhoods and wealthier people move in. But a new study focusing on Philadelphia has found that programs meant to help mitigate the risk of tax delinquency and displacement seem to be working as intended. Joining us now to talk about her research is Jacqueline Wong, co-author of the study conducted by the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia. Wong is also assistant professor of sociology at Stanford University. Welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Hi, thank you for having me.
A quick refresher, Philadelphia has seen an enormous amount of gentrification in recent years. Neighborhoods like Point Breeze, Fishtown, East Kensington, to name just a few. When houses and lots are overhauled and rebuilt, the most immediate impact is that property taxes can go up, which can make it difficult for the elderly and the poor to stay in place. So, Jacqueline, what was the jumping off point for your study?
So we were really focusing on the Philadelphia's actual value initiative, the tax overhaul that took place in 2013 and was implemented in 2014, where the city essentially reevaluated the assessed values for properties. So it reassessed the values to what they consider the real market value of the property. And as a result, as you mentioned, property taxes went up. So what we were looking at in terms of displacement were the out-migration rates or the exit rates among elderly or low credit score mortgage-holding residents after this initiative took place in 2013. And so essentially we're not finding that elderly and low credit score mortgage-holding residents are moving out of their neighborhoods at higher rates in gentrifying neighborhoods compared to non-gentrifying neighborhoods. I want to put a caveat around this. So we're only looking 2 years after these taxes went up. We're not looking at renters. And there's a lot of research that shows that people in low-income neighborhoods, so these neighborhoods that don't gentrify, also experience a lot of residential instability as well. And so certainly low-income homeowners are experiencing displacement. Anecdotally, there's evidence of this, but we're finding that those in gentrifying neighborhoods aren't necessarily moving out in general at higher rates than those in non-gentrifying neighborhoods. What explains these findings are the implementation of the LOOP program, we think. We looked at residents who qualified and use the long-term owner-occupants program.
And that is a city program, correct?
That's a new program that was implemented at the same time as the actual value initiative. And so this applied to long-term homeowners, those who own their homes for more than 10 years with income below 150% of the area median income. So these homeowners were protected from these property tax increases.
So, Jacqueline, how does this dovetail with the, you know, the very real narrative of distress and even fear we're hearing from people who are original residents of gentrifying neighborhoods?
It's a real thing that homeowners are likely experiencing displacement. The fears of displacement are very real as neighborhoods change. But what we're finding is that within these 2 years after the tax initiatives were implemented, there isn't really a change in their exit rates, and they're not at higher risk. And this is comparing them, once again, to neighborhoods, low-income neighborhoods that don't gentrify, which is generally occupied by people who often experience residential instability at high rates.
Jacqueline Wong, thank you so much for joining us for NewsWorks Tonight.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Jacqueline Wong is co-author of a study conducted by the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia regarding gentrification and displacement. And she is also assistant professor of sociology at Stanford University. The four suburban counties surrounding Philadelphia are carved up into 63 different school districts, some rich, some poor, some high-achieving, some not. Those district lines are a big deal, and it takes effort to maintain them. Almost every school district spends time and resources trying to root out families they suspect of lying about their address and illegally crossing district lines. But some worry this form of educational law and order leaves poor and minority students vulnerable. In the first installment of our three-part series called Kicked Out, WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt takes us into the world of disenrollment.
It starts with a tip. Maybe a kid accidentally tells her teacher she lives two towns over, or maybe a neighbor reports strange comings and goings at the house across the street.
I might get a phone call from a neighbor saying, hey, so-and-so doesn't live next door to me anymore. Here's the address.
Leanne Wenzel is the superintendent of the Ridley School District in Delaware County.
And then we put in for residency investigation.
If investigators find the student doesn't live in Ridley, the district moves to disenroll him or her. In other words, it kicks the student out.
That's the standard by law, and that's what we follow.
This type of thing happens routinely, hundreds of times in the Philadelphia suburbs, maybe thousands. WHYY tried to get a handle on just how many students get disenrolled from suburban schools and who gets disenrolled. But before we get to that, let's explore why districts disenroll students. School administrators like Frank Bruno of the William Penn School District in Delaware County will tell you it's all about fairness and money.
We are not the big bad bully standing there with the bat batting people away.
Bruno is in charge of pupil services for William Penn, a largely poor district just west of Philadelphia that has long struggled to fund its schools.
So we have to keep an eye on where our money's being used.
As part of that, William Penn keeps an eye on where its students live. Over the last 3 years, the district says it's notified about 3,000 families it suspects of residency fraud. In all, it's disenrolled 495 students.
We have to make sure that we are serving actual residents of our district who are helping to fund the district rather than interlopers who are coming in to get a free ride.
That idea of a free ride gets people agitated, especially these days, says Leanne Wenzel. Her district, like many, has hiked taxes to keep up with enrollments and pension costs.
Money comes into play, and it does something to people. It makes people feel something.
And it makes sense. The money people pay in school taxes is a direct investment in their kids, not the kids in the next district over. Maura McInerney, an attorney with the Education Law Center, says high-wealth school districts shell out big bucks for gleaming new facilities.
And in contrast, right next door, a 10-minute drive away, you have a school district that doesn't have up-to-date textbooks, that has overcrowded classrooms of 30-plus in a classroom.
In other words, you can understand why a family might fudge the facts and try to sneak into a neighboring district. Districts aren't required to track the number of kids they remove from school, But here's what we do know. Through a series of right-to-know requests, WHYY found 37 of 63 suburban districts did track the number of disenrollments over the past 3 years. Those 37 districts disenrolled a combined 1,600 students. But that may not tell the whole story. Several districts told us they often don't formally disenroll students. Instead, they'll confront families with evidence and those families will voluntarily leave. Dan McGarry is with the Upper Darby School District in Delaware County.
So they may just withdraw their child, and a withdrawal is different than disenrolling.
McGarry also says money isn't the only thing driving enforcement.
When some communities change and poverty increases in some communities and food and conduct changes here and there, it leads people to be frustrated.
Upper Darby is one of those changing communities. It's rapidly becoming less white and less affluent. McGarry thinks some local residents want the district to ramp up residency enforcement because they believe folks, coming from the outside, are hurting the district. Felicia Roach lives in another fast-changing community, Cheltenham in Montgomery County. We met recently at a coffee shop in the Germantown section of Philadelphia. It was here, in this struggling neighborhood, where Roach bounced between 5 elementary schools, multiple high schools, and eventually where she got pregnant and dropped out. A cousin who lived in the nearby suburbs had a less tumultuous experience.
So in the back of my mind, that was always the goal. If I have a kid, to make sure that they went to a school in a county and not in the city.
Roche is Black, and over the last 30 years, more and more Black families like hers have moved into Cheltenham, which borders North Philly.
I think it was a culture shock for them. They didn't know how to deal with that.
She thinks part of the way district officials dealt with it was through residency enforcement, specifically through challenging the residency of low-income minority residents. Roche says she's seen it firsthand. Just 2 years ago, she bickered with district officials who questioned whether her lease was legitimate.
It was a constant feeling of, even though you can legally be here, we don't want you to feel like you should be here. We want it to be as tough for you as possible. We want it to be as uncomfortable for you as possible.
Administrators in Cheltenham and elsewhere say that isn't their aim. They're just trying to enforce the rules. A lot of the skepticism, though, traces back to where we started. Remember, disenrollment usually starts with a tip. Someone believes someone else doesn't belong. Too often, says Maura McInerney, those suspicions stem from a common preconception. If you're poor or a minority, you may not be from around here.
Disproportionately, we have this implicit racial bias that's driving these referrals, that's driving people to call the school district and say, you should investigate that family.
Take a peek inside the world of residency enforcement, and you'll find a lot of the forces that shape education in Pennsylvania. Race, class, school funding, inequity, and changing demographics. We dug into the numbers to look at the scope and nature of disenrollment. Some of the findings were frustratingly incomplete, others were stark. We'll dive into those in our next installment. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
And to hear part two of our series Kicked Out, tune in to Morning Edition tomorrow. And to see how many kids your school district has disenrolled in recent years, head to whyy.org. The Pennsylvania primary is 2 weeks from today, and Republican voters will be picking a nominee for governor to take on Democratic incumbent Tom Wolf. This evening, we continue our series of interviews with the three Republican candidates by welcoming State Senator Scott Wagner. Wagner is a conservative businessman from York County who won election to the Senate in 2014. He's invested $6 million of his own funds into the campaign, which has been characterized by heavy TV advertising and sharp exchanges between Wagner and Pittsburgh businessman Paul Mango. Wagner spoke with WHYY's senior reporter Dave Davies.
Tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, how you got going in business.
I grew up in York, Pennsylvania, grew up on a farm. My mother gave horseback riding lessons for probably a little over 50 years. So I grew up in a blue-collar family. My father worked in construction, and it was a 25-acre farm. But high school graduate, didn't go to college. Age 19, I started my first business enterprise, and so I just continued over the years to start more businesses. And my current waste company, I started in 2000, and I have a trucking company, another waste company, but I employ about 600 people. I won a write-in campaign into the Senate in 2014, so I've been there for 4 years.
You got into office as a write-in candidate against a party-backed candidate for state senator in 2014. This is amazing. Almost never happens. And then you spent a lot of your personal money helping other Republican candidates around the state, county committees. You've clearly made a big commitment to politics. What drives this? What do you want to accomplish?
Well, I think we need to see change in Pennsylvania. You know, but the bottom line is that I think we can do better in Pennsylvania. The government that I see in Harrisburg is wildly out of control, and it needs to be reined in. It needs to be managed. We're behind in a lot of areas when you compare Pennsylvania to national. You know, our unemployment rate in Pennsylvania is 4.8%. The national average is 4.1%, and I think it's going to go under 4%. We can do so much better, but it requires leadership.
You know, when I look at your career and the things that you say, it strikes me that you are deeply motivated by what you've learned in your own experience running a business where there's a bottom line, where you have to meet a payroll, and you're dealing with a government that has regulations that are probably feel burdensome, bureaucrats that take forever to make a decision, and you want to bring some of those principles to government. I wonder if you ever think there are things about governing that you don't know, like what it actually takes to run the Department of Health or Human Services, and if you're ever concerned that maybe there's more to that.
Well, Dave, I will admit to you there is a lot that I don't know. You know, my style of management will be to go into these departments and basically with this question, tell me what you do here. Tell me about the department of so-and-so and how it operates. And those are powerful questions. That's what leaders do. And that's not a system that we have in place.
Should we increase the state's minimum wage?
I think we should.
How much?
I think we should increase the minimum wage to probably somewhere around $9.50, $9.75. Listen, you cannot find people at minimum wage. This is a debate that we just need to get off the table and move on. But I am also not in favor of raising the minimum wage the whole way back. I think there should be a training wage up to 18 years old. You know, and I think there would be a phase-in period of, you know, 50 or 75 cents, you know, every 6 months. But at the end of the day, we have a skilled labor crisis right now. We have a shortage. People can't find people.
Your opponent, Paul Mango, attacked you for co-sponsoring legislation to extend equal protection to LGBT citizens. Why did you back that legislation?
Well, I was asked to co-sponsor that bill 2 years ago, and I did some research. I went to an employment law attorney, and the bottom line is that as an employer, I could deny someone employment based on their, you know, their sexual orientation or sexual preference, and that's wrong. So that bill was specific to housing, employment, and public accommodations. And, you know, I don't discriminate my company, period. But my agenda is treating people equally, and that is a very big issue in this state.
You have been compared to Donald Trump. You know, you're both independently wealthy businessmen who are very plain-spoken, got into politics in unconventional ways. Do you welcome that comparison?
I grew up on a farm in a blue-collar family. Donald Trump grew up in the New York real estate market. His father was a workaholic entrepreneur. So Donald Trump and I come from very different, you know, backgrounds. But Donald Trump went to Washington pushing change and draining the swamp. And, you know, he's had a lot of resistance. And this is where there's a big comparison difference. Donald Trump had no relationships in Washington, D.C. Fast forward to Scott Wagner. Scott Wagner gets elected into the state Senate in 14. I've been there for 4 full years. I know the inner workings of Harrisburg, and I built a lot of relationships. I know how to solve the problems. That's a big advantage I have over the president. I don't tweet. You know, I'm not a career politician. I'm not a polished, smooth guy. I'm a blue-collar guy that graduated from high school. I've been fortunate in Pennsylvania. I understand the issues inside and out. That's where I have a very big advantage. So that's the difference between Scott Wagner and the president.
Scott Wagner, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
You're very welcome.
WHYY's Dave Davies spoke with Scott Wagner, a state senator from York County and one of 3 Republican candidates for governor. Last month, Dave spoke with Pittsburgh attorney Laura Ellsworth, and we'll have Pittsburgh businessman Paul Mango in our studio soon. 200 years ago, an enterprising English artist created the first large-scale book of urban images in America, and he focused on Philadelphia. William Birch's Views of Philadelphia became the definitive vision around the world of American urban life. WHYY's Peter Crimmins tells us of a new exhibit about Birch's successes and failures.
Before William Birch arrived in the United States in 1794, he had already had a career in England that soared and crashed. When his circle of aristocratic patrons started aging out, he packed up and tried his hand in the New World. Librarian Jim Green with the Library Company of Philadelphia said when that old world artist arrived in Philadelphia, instead of finding a backwater colony of log cabins and bear pelts, he got swept up in a bustling urban city with classical architecture.
I want to do it all. No one's ever done it before. This is wide open territory, which is something that you find with so many people who come to America.
What Birch did was create Views of Philadelphia. It's a book of 27 large-scale, full-color renderings of life in an American city. No one had ever done that before. It's now on display at the Library Company in Center City. The scenes of streets and riverbanks show the city of Philadelphia and the people that populated it, the merchants, the artisans, the shoppers, even Native Americans on a day trip. The picture set was sold by subscription, and it was a huge hit, said curator Sarah Weatherwax.
There were a lot of merchants, Philadelphia merchants, who purchased or who subscribed to the City Views. Thomas Jefferson kept his copy, you know, on his sofa, I believe, according to Birch, and showed it to everybody who came to the White House.
Birch's images even made their way back over the Atlantic and resold in Europe. After the success of City Views, Birch created a companion book, Country Views, featuring bucolic images of grand country estates. That book was a flop, perhaps because Birch wanted to educate his readers in English aristocratic taste and Americans weren't having it. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan for NewsWorks Tonight.